Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you today?
And as usual, we're going to be talking about the cosmic influence, things that influence life on Earth over very long periods of time. And this is the subject of the book that I wrote that Jeff helped write with me and research. And it talks about ancient cultures and the idea that they believed in a vast cycle of time, one with alternating dark and golden ages. And in exploring how this cycle manifests, we have been interviewing people that either have some knowledge of the astronomy or some knowledge of ancient cultures or some knowledge of what life may have been like in the higher ages. And so Jeff and I are on a trip here. We're just having a whole lot of fun doing this. And
we really are. It's a journey, and it's different every day.
Every day. And today we have a very interesting speaker, one that has been with us at our prior conferences, the Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge, and a person that probably knows more about angels and archetypes than anyone I've ever met. She has been to Egypt over 20 times, and we're really delighted to have on board Carmen Bolter. And Jeff will give a proper introduction here.
Well, Dr. Carmen Bolter is a professor at the University of Calgary in Canada, and she teaches in the Graduate Division of Educational Research. She's been researching and writing about the sacred feminine in ancient Egypt and goddesses around the world for two decades. Her book, Angels and Archetypes, An Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness, traces fragments of information about matriarchal cultures in pre-dynastic Egypt and prehistoric Greece. Carmen leads sacred site journeys to Peru, Tibet, the Mediterranean, and Egypt. She's currently working on a documentary series called The Pyramid Code, which explores the gap between the traditional science and ancient mysteries. And I've seen the preview for The Pyramid Code, and it looks fascinating. Carmen, I know you've been working on it for a few years now and conducting interviews at the CPAC conferences. I can't wait to see the finished product. But in the meantime, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So where are you on that project as far as the finished product goes?
Well, we're definitely in post-production. I've just come back from shooting again in high definition in Egypt, and we went down to Nabta Playa, the megalithic site, Neolithic megalithic site in the middle of the desert.
And, oh, that's supposed to be one of the oldest there, isn't it?
It sure is. And so I've got the 3D graphic artists working, and we're, you know, just finishing up here with the editing. And so it could be maybe 2-3 more months, and we've got something. It'll be a 6-episode series.
Outstanding.
That's fantastic. Well, I can't wait to see it when it's done.
Thanks.
So you've been to Egypt more than 20 times. What's captivated you about that place?
I started having past life memories when I was 6 years old, and I was seeing visions of Egyptian priestesses. And so when I was 11, I found a book that had a picture of the inside of the Great Pyramid, and I just kind of went crazy and was asking my mother, where's Egypt? And she said, well, look in the atlas. And how do you get there? And she said, well, phone the airlines. And so there I was, 11 years old, wishing to go to Egypt, and I ended up there when I was 21 for the first time. And lots of things got triggered in that first trip, and I ended up, you know, really researching a lot after that and then going back over and over again. Basically, what I was doing is tracing my visions. I'd have images of temples, and, you know, I understood about high-level initiates, and lots of things were triggering me. And after that first trip, I spent 3.5 hours in the Great Pyramid, and there were apparitions in my pictures. And so I went to a camera place and asked if there was something wrong with my camera, and they said no. And then I thought, well, what is all this energy, and what am I feeling when I'm here, and that sort of thing. So I kept going back over and over again. It took about 10 years to find this one temple that I kept having visions of when I wasn't in Egypt. And then I'd get to Egypt, and it would be like I'm getting closer and getting warm and then getting cool, and basically, I was looking for the roots of where I had been involved with the high-level initiates. And so since then, I've been trying to recreate the sociocultural context for what their trainings were and what was really going on around the pyramids.
Sounds like you've been taking as much of an inner journey as an outer journey through this whole process. And speaking of journeys, we need to have a quick break here. You're listening to Cosmic Influence.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host, Walter Crutenden, and our guest today, Dr. Carmen Bolter. If at any point you'd like more information on what we do with the Cosmic Influence or at the Binary Research Institute, you can visit our website at www.binaryresearchinstitute.org. Carmen, welcome back to the program. So before the break, we were talking about what's captivated you about Egypt and going back over there, and you touched on
it being in something that's almost an intuitive journey for you. And you said you spent several hours inside the Great Pyramid. I've read about accounts of people that have spent the night there, and it's been there's been some amazing stories. I was wondering, did you feel anything profound when you were there?
Oh, absolutely. And what I think here is that I've been on a multidimensional and a multidisciplinary journey to try to put the pieces back together. I have spent a tremendous amount of time inside the Great Pyramid alone and with private groups. I tend not to like it in there when it's just open to the public because the pyramid tends to be a magnifier of our thoughts. And so when people are not being really clear and focused and they're just chatting about things, it tends to really get magnified, and that's very, very uncomfortable. The pyramid has energy, there's no question. I think that it was connected to a larger world grid that has been shut down, but still, if you get real close to the pyramids and inside, I think that energy, that original energy that the pyramids were built for, still exists.
Well, there's a lot of people that have been investigating what the pyramids' original purpose may have been, and it's interesting to hear your perspective that it's a magnifier of thoughts there and part of a larger grid. I too feel that it has some great meaning, but I really don't know at this point.
Well, and I think that's something that even some ancient Greek scholars wrote about as well. And I think one of the interesting things is there really aren't any hieroglyphs or any evidence that anyone was ever buried in the Great Pyramids. There's no evidence that they were used for tombs, unlike some of the smaller surrounding tombs and pyramids, which even the ones that have been ransacked and pillaged still show a lot of evidence that someone was buried in there at one point.
That's what I'd like. Your thoughts on that whole thing, sort of the traditional interpretation versus your intuitive interpretation of, you know, these sites.
Well, I think that there's a real, I want to say conspiracy, but that's too strong a word, an agenda to prevent us from knowing what really was going on in ancient Egypt. And so there seems to be this storyline that they repeat and they teach kids in school that the pyramids were tombs, even though they've never found a mummy in any pyramid, the flat-sided pyramids. There's a distinction with a mastaba, a step pyramid, or a flat-topped stone structure that definitely could have been a tomb. But it's really just a fabrication that they tell us that the pyramids were tombs. So
well,
I think that the... Sorry?
I was just going to say, until we really know, until a better explanation comes along that people can agree on, I guess the old explanation will just sit there for a while.
Well, I don't know that that people like Zahi Hawass, the Supreme Council of Antiquities, is ever going to agree with anything that's alternative. And I think that part of this is rooted in the patriarchal ways of being and thinking, where archaeology doesn't speak to anthropology, doesn't speak to linguistics, and so it's difficult for us to put the picture back together. The Bible wants us to think we're 6,000 years old, even though they talk about ages. And so it's difficult for us to go into these vast cycles of time and imagine how the ancients could have been wiser, more switched on, had more senses firing, and they were actually in a whole different energetic grid. I don't think that it was static energy, static electricity. I think it was a magnetic kind of energy that was going on, and that they were able to transmute the atom. There's lots of information in Indian texts about the Siddhis, S-I-D-H-I-S, and these are six different things that they were able to do that all involved the transmutation of the atom: telepathy, bilocation, levitation, manifestation, alchemy, and teleportation. And there was something about building a charge inside their bodies, something about cosmic energy being grounded on the earth plane that had to go through the human divining rod, if you will. And so the high-level initiates were basically part of this charge. And you notice on a lot of the temple drawings that they have metal bands on their upper arms, their wrists, and their ankles. And there was something about that that allowed them to hold the energy in a different way, and so it wasn't going to, as I say, electromagneticute them. Because there was a real danger with so much energy coming through that they actually, would overcharge their bodies. So there was training programs that went on along the Nile dealing with each chakra of the initiates, and they really had to be trained in a way before they ended up in the pyramid fields that I've come to know as the Band of Peace. So each of these pyramids has a different angle and shape. The bent pyramid actually has two, and I see these as resonance chambers. So over the years, I spent a lot of time on the plateau digging around. In the years before the big wall went up, at the end of the British occupancy, all the land around the Giza Plateau was given to actually Dodi Fayed's grandfather, and my friend is his first cousin, and so he, made me able to go out on the plateau almost every night at sunset. And I can tell you that I spent a lot of time inside the body of the Sphinx, and I know that there's a honeycomb of passageways that goes all the way underneath the pyramids that used to fill up with water when the Nile flooded. And the Nile, of course, has migrated, and it would create these echoing sound resonance chambers. And I think the high-level initiates would gather in groups around each of these pyramid areas, and there was a different tone that would ring through the pyramids based on their shape, and it would create this incredible charge that it moved mountains. I mean, it really was a very powerful thing that they were involved in.
Boy, that's a deep view of things. I noticed, you've studied many ancient cultures beyond Egyptian, and you had one story in your book. I think you were at Crete, where you were led to go out into a field. And I like your approach to research. It's not just book research, but you're letting your intuition lead you there. And I think that's what I hear you talking about now.
Yes. In that situation, it was at the palace of King Minos, they say, and I had this gut reaction. King? What do you mean? Like, that's not what I saw it as, because I was pretty sure it was a matriarchal culture. And all of a sudden, I felt like I was just being lifted right out, and I ran up this hill and ended up in this clearing and thought, well, what's here? Nothing. I can't see anything. Yes, it's a pretty view, but there was something so strong going on that I kind of took a picture, an internal psychic picture of what was going on, and decided that I was going to be committed to finding out what went on in that spot. And again, it took me 10 years. I ended up getting two research assistants for full-time to help me do the research on these matriarchal cultures. And the original research question was, what happened in the switchover between matriarchy that gave way to patriarchy? And a lot of the journals that they were coming up with didn't exist anywhere. None of the libraries had them. And so I ended up in Montreal at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute Library doing research for a whole summer. And there, inside the feminist journals, I ended up finding a map of Knossos from the past, and it was the sacred grove, a of oak trees that was in that spot. And, of course, when the Christians came along, they chopped all the trees down. And, of course, there was no trace that that's where they did their ceremonies. But I was led right to that spot. And I just kept digging and digging and digging until I found out what was relevant about that spot. And that's a similar story to the visions that I had of the temples, or the one particular temple where I had lived. And I looked and looked and looked and looked and looked for it in Egypt. And finally, I found it. And when my foot touched the stones of the floor, instantly it turned into a movie where I could see the priestesses in their robes, and I could smell the flowers and see the candles, and I knew if I went around a corner there was a little door, and it was the most incredible thing. But in the 10 years prior, looking, I came across many places that the answer was no. So the contrast on a visceral level of yes and no was quite dramatic. So that's sort of the idea of following my hunches and then following it up with anthropological or archaeological research or geology or something like that, that kind of puts the story back together.
Well, one of your hunches has been in the area of matriarchal cultures, and I think what you've referred to as sort of divine feminism. And we are hearing more and more, I think, traditional archaeologists, historians are recognizing to some small degree that in the very distant past, we had much more of a matriarchal culture out there. Can you give us your views on this subject?
Well, it seems that corresponding to the Mayan calendar, 3113 BC, is when the first dynasty was. And so it seems to me that pretty much everything in history, history is when the soldiers came, and that date sort of demarcates what historical archives are talking about. But it seems to me that everything before it for a very long period of time was matriarchal. Now, most people are afraid that if patriarchy was about blood and war, and basically it's blood from death instead of blood from life, that if matriarchy would be the opposite of that, of the women controlling the men, and I don't really think that's the idea at all. In matriarchal cultures, it's my understanding that DNA, the menstrual blood, was the highest form of DNA, and so it's actually blood from life that was used in the rituals. And then when the patriarchs took over, they needed to use sacrificial lambs, and they started to get blood from death. And so the whole idea, like, Freud was in there with Darwin, and he was talking about penis envy, but really I think it's procreation envy. And so if we look at the Neolithic cultures, many of them were obviously matriarchal, but I don't think that that's women having the power as much as balance being what was important. So ancient Egypt, to me, has many, many symbols of the balance between the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine. And if you look at the frescoes that have the profile view, you'll often see the left foot slightly forward, which is basically saying we're in balance, but we slightly lead with the holistic view of the right brain, which sees symbols and, you know, looks into the unconscious.
With the feminine side, so to speak.
The feminine side. And in patriarchal cultures, basically it's just all, if you don't see it, it's not there. And things are segregated and divided. And I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't been able to understand the ancients, is because we've been looking at it through the vision of patriarchal lenses.
Well, it's also the division between the higher ages and the lower ages. And speaking of divisions, we need to tell everyone they're listening to Cosmic Influence, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. You had mentioned, Carmen, the date 3113, I believe, which was, it's the start of the Mayan calendar. A date very close to that is 3102 BC, which is the dividing point between the higher and lower ages in this Indian or Vedic cycle of the ages, the way they separate the great year. And according to Paramahansa Yogananda and Sri Yukteswar and some others, in the higher ages, we have telepathic, clairvoyant abilities, and we lose those in the lower ages. And so it may not simply be a division between sort of a matriarchal and a patriarchal culture as much as it is, a wholeness of consciousness to a lesser consciousness. And in a lesser consciousness, you know, I do think that more animal instincts take over, as evidenced with the brutality during the Dark Ages. But fortunately, we're on our way back up. Anyway, I wanted to get around to one other thing. You'd mentioned that you visited Nabta Playa recently, which is thought to be one of the oldest sites in Egypt. And I would love to hear your thoughts there.
Yes, well, it's actually so obscure to get there. We ended up having to go from Cairo down into the western desert through Asyut and El Minya, where Amarna is, and down into El Karga. Had to wait 3 days for permits and then go out on the open desert in 2 four-wheel-drive vehicles carrying all our food, water, and gas. And the only way to find Nabta Playa was with GPS. And it was really an adventure. And so you end up coming upon this huge site with stone circles that are obviously calendrical. And from doing some of the research that Thomas Brophy and a few other people had done through satellite imaging, we see that these were star calendars that were tracing Sirius and Orion and the circumnavigation around the pole star. And the hearths, even though a lot of the carbon-14 dating, in my opinion, and there's other scientists who agree with this, is makes things look younger. The older you go back in, the farther you go back in time, the more the carbon-14 makes things look a little younger than they are. And they're still dating the hearths, the charcoal from them, at 8,000 B.C. That's... And so these are the cattle cults that I think were the beginning of the Hathor energy. But what you can see by going across the open desert is the old riverbed of the Nile. Now, the Nile has migrated 50 miles from the west, moving along. And when you look at the pyramids, you can see that the river has moved 8 miles to the east. So in some ways, we can begin to date from a geological standpoint, like how long it takes for a river to migrate. And so this was at an oasis. And it seems that the people who had the cattle cults would come in when the water would rise. And this would happen corresponding to solstice, and then the river would flood, and solstice was heralded by the heliacal rising of Sirius. So just before sunrise, Sirius would come up, and so the cattle cult people knew when to go to the oasis, and so it seems that they were migratory. But what's so interesting about these astronomical alignments is that if you go directly, let me get this right, east, you end up at Aswan, where on Elephantine Island you get the temple to Sathis, and that is, again, looking at exactly the same astronomical alignments that are replicated at the pyramids. And so when we're talking 8,000 B.C., and then we're talking the Pharaonic Age, and who knows about the pyramids, because it's my conviction that they're even older than that. So we've got this link with a whole different culture that could have predated Pharaonic Egypt, but also could be the cradle of it. So this is pretty fascinating. And, you know, even when they're talking about the Giza Plateau and in Robert Bovall's theory of the Orion, the lining up of Orion's belt being in 2500 B.C. when they claim that the pyramids were built. But it also comes around in the grand cycle, half a precession before that, 11,500 B.C. And so how old would that be? And you know, at Nabta Playa, they say that some of those stars are pointing to situations in the heavens as far back as 16,000 B.C. So, you know, you may say, okay, well, they were marking the stars for thousands of years, but the pyramids were built in 2500 B.C., and somebody was there marking the stars. Well, who? who was marking the stars and why. So these things are, I think, carving deeper into the idea of the older dating for the pyramids. Now, I think that there's something with academia where the more connected somebody is to a university setting, the less they want to date things far back. So it's super interesting because
well, you have to be conservative, or
you have to be
booted out, right?
Well, and Egyptology, you know, is claiming that you know things happen in a certain time frame. But then, you know, they're finding skeletons in Africa that are, you know, 250,000 years old or a million years old. Well, who are these people? Now, we always want to say that they're not very sophisticated, but when you see this ancient star calendar, it makes you wonder. Now, I'll say this, too. Out in the open desert, when there's no lights and the moon is a crescent shape or a new moon, all you got is the stars. And so it makes sense that they would follow them. But if you think that, you know, Starry Night Pro is a very sophisticated program and it's basically tracing the stars, how could they have known what was going on in these large cycles of time? It's fascinating to see. But for sure at Napta Playa, we've got something that's very, very old.
Right. Well, it tells you they have some knowledge of the movement of the heavens precession, which Giorgio Santayana had talked about, the former professor of the history of science at MIT, who documented that over 30 ancient cultures were aware of this, even though, you know, Western science tends to think that precession knowledge of precession is a fairly new phenomena. Anyway, we need to take a quick break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to the Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host Walter Cruttenden, and our guest today is Dr. Carmen Bolter. Carmen, right before the break, we were talking about Napta Playa and how old possibly the cultures in the Egypt area are. And I was watching the Discovery Channel a few nights ago, and they had a documentary on the Sahara, on the history of the Sahara. And what I found fascinating was that before 8,000 BC, and in fact, even leading up into 3,000 BC, when dynastic Egypt was starting, the Sahara was not really a desert. It was just becoming a desert after having been a very lush savanna land for several thousand years, and basically the peoples of that area migrated east towards where the Nile was, because that was the last of the fertile ground in that area. So there's a lot of potential for cultures to have been spread out all across northern Africa and to really have developed and then just been abandoned as that land became unlivable.
Yes, and it's just unmistakable when you look at the area north of Napta Playa. You stand up on a hill and you can see that it used to have a water base. It had to be in a water basin by the shape of things. But if you walk around down there, you find shells and all kinds of things that would indicate that the water basin has actually moved. Now, when you start speaking to geology, then you can start dating that sort of thing. But it's true that the Sahara was not always a desert. And so that starts to help us piece the picture back together. Yeah, it's a very, very important point.
Well, we'll have to get Thomas Brophy on the show someday. We've met with him a few times, and I know he wrote that book on Napta Playa, so let's see if we can get him on.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with Napta Playa, what I think is interesting is people think, well, why would anyone build these monuments out in the middle of the desert? And the reality is it wasn't a desert at the time that they were built. It was very fertile ground. It was a place you'd want to live.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Well, beyond visiting many of these sites, Carmen, much of your work has involved investigating what I would call the ancient goddesses. And much of your book, Angels and Archetypes, is about the goddesses. How did you really get interested in that, and what's that all about?
I mentioned that I had two research assistants that came from a community college, and I got a call from them when I was the director of the Women's Therapy and Research Center, and they said, if you could investigate any topic at all, what would it be? And we're going to give you two full-time assistants to dig around in that. So I found myself thinking, okay, what do I really want to know? And the original research question is, how did matriarchy give way to patriarchy? And so I started researching. It took me about 10 years to research for that book. You'll see that there's a 22-page bibliography in it. And I was looking at fragments of matriarchal cultures, and then how the names of the goddess temples were then changed into names of gods, and how things changed, but that the original ideas of the archetypal energy were still within the sacred feminine. So there's something about patriarchal ways of being and thinking that kind of erased all those empowered feminine images. And so I really wanted to just put them back on the map. And so it's a system of 22 goddesses, and their higher selves are angels. But from an archetypal standpoint, each of us has the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine within. And there's these different aspects that correspond to numerology, astrology, and the tarot, but really they're psychological constructs. And so if we are not able to fully be conscious of all the aspects, what happens is that they can end up constellating and then driving us instead of us being fully conscious. And so the idea of being able to understand how these archetypal energies work and how feminine consciousness, both inside men and women, is definitely part of our wholeness. This idea became very important to me in terms of being able to share that. I was working as a psychologist at the time, and it became very instructive for my clients to be understanding things in an archetypal way, because an archetype is something that exists whether you're conscious of it or not. And so that's what I was up to with the book.
Well, it's an impressive piece of work, and this this healing quality of recognizing an archetype is something we've experienced here as we've been investigating this great year in the last golden age, according to much of the Vedic Indian dating, is around about 11,500 BC or so. Many people, when they hear about it, they've written us emails and said, you know, as a little girl, I had believed in a golden age, and then I was taught in school that it wasn't real, and so I sort of stuffed it down. Then when I saw your work, it was like a catharsis. And so it tells me that there's information there that we need to know to have a better understanding of history, and it's not just for intellectual purposes. It's to make us more whole as individuals.
Well, and herstory, too, then.
Herstory, too.
And good. History and herstory.
Good point. Good point. Good. Well, what exactly do you teach, then, at the University of Calgary? You're involved in so many subjects here.
Yeah, that's true. I did my doctorate in linguistics, and I'm actually teaching educational technology. So I'm interested in technology from every standpoint, the technology of the ancients. So I teach online, and so my students are from all over the world. And so I create these online courses, and they're all graduate courses. So I teach quantitative research methods, how to do research, and like that.
Terrific.
Yep. I was going to do my PhD in archaeology, and then I realized, and I actually did, the equivalent of the undergrad work, it. I've got 15 years post-secondary degrees here.
Wow.
But I realized that with archaeology, you basically have to toe the party line, and you can't really make statements that don't fit with the paradigm that they're teaching. So I realized that I'd be probably better off to do something that's a little bit more neutral, like linguistics.
Right. Who is the UCLA professor, Maria
Gimbutas?
Gimbutas, right, who found a tremendous amount of evidence for matriarchal cultures, and I was very impressed by her work, but I guess she was always a bit of an outcast because her thoughts were too revolutionary for the patriarchs of the time, I suppose.
Yeah, she made a big contribution. And the other thing is that a lot of the things that deeper is older in archaeology, and so it took a while for us to get down to those lower levels to find all the little goddess dolls that they had and the... Yeah, so
right, I hear they really found over 500 of those now just through her work. Anyway, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden here with Jeff Pitino, and today we're talking with Professor Carmen Bolter of the University of Calgary. And for those that of you that would like to know more about Carmen's work, we invite you not only to pick up a copy of her book, Angels and Archetypes, but also think about attending next year's CPAC, Conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge. It'll be held October 4th
and 5th at UC San Diego.
And Carmen will be speaking there. And your topic, Carmen, will be?
I'll be looking at the matriarchal aspects of ancient Egypt and recreating the sociocultural context of the high-level initiates there.
Excellent. Well, we have a lot of initiates that attend CPAC, so it'd be great to hear your perspective.
Carmen, we mentioned earlier the documentary series you're working on, The Pyramid Code, which I can't wait for. What originally got you into documentary filmmaking, and what approach did you decide to take in building this series?
Okay, I had written a manuscript called Out of the Blue, which actually was written more like a screenplay. And it's piecing together the sociocultural context, as I was saying. And a director in Hollywood actually got a hold of it and said, well, why don't we start with a documentary? He had a producer in mind, and he said, how about we meet you in Egypt in 2 weeks? And off we went and started shooting. Got quite a lot of good footage, and then started doing interviews with people that would corroborate some of the things that we were finding. The approach that we were taking is to look at Hakim Awiyan's work, and he's been my mentor for a long time in Egypt, and he's been an archaeologist for 53 years, and now he's 83 years old, and I was kind of interested in getting his story before he passes. And he is an indigenous wisdom keeper, and he was born at Abusir, which is the center of this the band of pieces, I've called it. And so he had lots of stories about, you know, climbing through the passageways underneath the pyramids that go all the way to Saqqara, and the matriarchal energies and the linguistic connections to the ancient Suf language, which is, and he calls Egypt Kemp, the land of the black soil. And so we got 9 hours of interview with him, and then I was looking for scientists that would corroborate some of what he said, and piecing it together from an ancient standpoint and then from a modern standpoint. So it's been a real interesting ride, and it wasn't long into it before I realized that this was a series and that we had quite a bit more to say than just one episode. So right now it's 6 episodes, and I've got a team of post-production people and 3D graphics people in New York, Baltimore, and Oakland, California. So it's interesting to be doing this project and spanning, you know, one coast to the other and taking people over to Egypt to do shoots and that sort of thing. So that's how it got started.
And I know you have interviews there in that film with John Anthony West, Robert Schock, I believe Graham Hancock, and Robert Bovall, many of our regulars at CPAC, and people that have been on the show, too. So that,
yes, that's true.
That should be great.
And speaking of going to Egypt, like we mentioned before, you've been there over 20 times, and your first trip there was in 1977. How has Egypt changed from your perspective over the last 30 years?
Well, it seems like the government's become more and more and more restrictive. In the early days, there wasn't even a gate, and now they've put up a wall that's got to be, it's 15 feet high, but it's got to be 20 miles long that goes all the way around the plateau, and they've just locked things shut. It's getting harder and harder to get around and to get special permissions to do things, and I wonder what all the fuss is about, because, you know, the plateau was there for thousands of years without a wall around it. So it just seems more and more soldiers and more restriction. I'm not going to say that it's dangerous there. But there certainly is a very active military presence. I remember in 1999, just before the shift to 2000, thousands of troops came in. And, you know, even this last trip, there's soldiers all over the place. So it's a little bit disconcerting to see that. And there's actually a temple to ISIS on the left side of the Sphinx, and they cemented over the top of it. So, you know, the chances of being able to actually do archaeological digs through the cement are becoming more and more remote. Things like the King's Chamber used to be black, and I didn't realize that it was actually pink granite, and it's from an explosion that happened in there. There's a big crack inside the King's Chamber. And so just as we're getting on to this idea that there's evidence of an explosion in there, all of a sudden the Department of Antiquities closes the pyramid and cleans it, so now it's pink granite in there. So, you know, it seems that they're really going to a lot of trouble to stop any kind of alternative theories from coming out. But personally, I think it's a bit late. I think the evidence has been seen, and that there's enough people who are conscious and thinking about it in a different way. So I think it's kind of like locking the barn after the horse has been stolen, personally.
Well, there's certainly plenty of different thoughts and ideas about what was going on in ancient times, and they were very obscure when I was growing up, and now Jeff and I, we spend our whole life, I know you do too, in this sort of alternative history world, and I think it's getting more and more cohesive as time comes along here, and the idea of understanding that time might be cyclical and that there were indeed higher ages, and much of this knowledge was lost, and now we're just coming back and sort of rediscovering much of it, I believe helps put it in perspective.
Right, and I think really regardless of what one's perspective is, whether you lean towards alternative theories or the what would be considered the traditional theories, I think it's important that the questions be asked, because without that, we're never going to continue to learn more about how rich human history really is.
Yes, and I think we're all naturally curious about it, and I think it's particularly high-level initiates that have reincarnated that are sitting at these conferences and asking these questions. I definitely think we're remembering.
Good. Well, Carmen, we're coming near the end of the show, and I just want to thank you for taking the time to be with us and invite any viewers or listeners that are interested in your work once again to pick up your book, Angels and Archetypes. And do you have a website again?
Pyramidcode.com.
Okay, great.
So they can look at the trailer and connections to trips and that sort of thing.
Great.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for being on the program, and we look forward to seeing your presentation at CPAC coming up next
year. I'm looking forward to it, too. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carmen. That was a great conversation with Carmen. And I feel that we kind of have an advantage that our listeners don't have, in that we get to read the books on all these people we interview.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we just barely had time to scratch the surface of her work, but it is a fascinating field, and she is quite a scholar.
She really is, and it was great getting to talk to her. And once again, she will be at next year's CPAC conference. If you'd like more information on the conference, please visit the website, www.cpaconline.com. That's CPAKonline.com.
Or for more information on our work here at the Binary Research Institute, that's just www.binaryresearchinstitute.org. And we thank you again for listening to Cosmic Influence. And
bring on the higher ages.